MySpace says it's not going to compete with Facebook anymore.
They were competing?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, October 27th. The social networking site MySpace says it is done competing with Facebook. That company, which was purchased for more than $500 million by News Corp 5 years ago, is relaunching today. Now it wants to be an entertainment destination.
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer is covering this story for us, and she's with us now from Washington. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning.
Well, Nancy, when I saw this story, my first thought was, MySpace is still competing with Facebook? I thought that competition was over.
Well, Jeremy, that's the perception they're fighting against with this relaunch. They do say they're not competing with Facebook, and they say the idea is, unlike Facebook, you're not connecting with your long-lost friends. Instead, on the new MySpace, you'll be able to chat about TV shows and movies and learn about new bands.
But wasn't that always sort of the focus of MySpace, was more on entertainment and music?
Well, yeah, but some people think this is actually MySpace's first step into our living rooms. At least that's what Joseph Turo says. He teaches communications at the University of Pennsylvania. He told me MySpace may be aiming to be a part of that transition from cable TV to our TVs being hooked up to the internet. For example, MySpace could become a place to watch a concert.
The concert gets behind a firewall, and you have to pay to get on the concert, and that can be streamed to the big set. It becomes a channel which a lot of it is given out for free, but some of it can be charged almost on a pay-per-view, video-on-demand basis.
And Jeremy, this relaunch is just crucial for MySpace. Its revenues are way down. eMarketer estimates that advertisers will spend about $347 million on MySpace this year. Last year, they spent $470 million.
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And while we're in internet land, a federal judge has put an end to the file-sharing website LimeWire. It'll be permanently shut down because of what the judge called copyright infringement on a massive scale.
What do you do when you think your debt is unmanageable? Some people turn to these debt settlement services, companies that promise to deal with your creditors and straighten out your problems, all for a fee. Well, starting today, a new rule from the Federal Trade Commission means consumers won't have to pony up that fee up front. Marketplace's David Gura explains.
Used to be, people who turned to debt settlement services had to pay them a monthly fee to try to reduce their debt. That process could take years. And trouble was, people had to pay even if there was no progress.
In the past, you'd paid fees and really not gotten the benefit. There's a new rule now that the debt settlement companies are not supposed to take the fees until they actually settle at least one debt.
Gail Hillebrand of Consumers Union says it's high time companies were restricted from charging clients any money until they reached an agreement to reduce some of what the client owes. Jenna Keenan heads a group representing dozens of debt settlement companies. She says the industry as a whole offers a valuable service.
I think it's important that people understand there's a big distinction between actual debt settlement companies and scam artists. If they're a criminal, they're a criminal, regardless of the hat they're wearing.
And, Keenan says, many small debt settlement businesses can't operate without those monthly payments. In Los Angeles, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The Fed may opt for a smaller approach to economic stimulus than some had thought. Monetary policymakers meet next week in Washington and will decide whether to pump more money into the economy to try to bring down long-term interest rates. But now there are reports they may move more incrementally. For more, we're joined by Richard DeKayser, an economist with the Parthenon Group. He's in Boston. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Well, Richard, the story everybody's talking about this morning in the Wall Street Journal, it says the Fed may actually pump less new money into the economy than previously thought. If that ends up being true, what's the reason for it?
Well, I think we're in fine-tuning mode right now, and this contrasts with where we were back in, say, November of 2008 and early 2009 when the economy was absolutely in crisis. Employment was in free fall. Now we're looking at an economy that's stabilized. It's just not growing as quick as the Fed would like. So I think they're likely to move incrementally and make it conditional upon economic outcomes. As long as inflation is too low and unemployment too high, they'll continue. But if both those metrics get back where they'd like, the Fed will call it quits.
And briefly, Richard, we got durable goods orders numbers this morning from the Commerce Department. These are big ticket items like refrigerators and computers that companies buy. They were up 3% in September. Is that good news?
Well, it is, but only on a qualified basis. Durable goods are important because it reflects business and consumer willingness to basically stick their necks out, buy these big ticket items. But the reason for today's big surge had almost entirely to do with aircraft orders. Boeing in particular reported a huge book of orders. When they do, that skews the numbers. If you net that out, you actually saw a modest decline. So this brings us back to the Fed. These are the concerns that the Fed is trying to battle. Businesses and consumers are wary. The Fed's trying to counter those forces, and that's why they're doing exactly what they are.
Okay, Richard DeKayser, thanks.
My pleasure.
Richard DeKayser, economist with the Parthenon Group.
Just a few shopping days left until Halloween, and I don't have a costume yet. I could spend, less than half a million dollars on an original Darth Vader costume.
Sounds like a good deal to me.
I don't know about that. Maybe not, but as Marketplace's Eve Trow reports, we're all going to be spending a bit more this Halloween.
Consumers may be spooked about the overall economy, but Halloween sales are expected to grow 4% this year. That's got retailers thinking,
it's alive!
More stores want in on the Halloween act. At Los Angeles boutique Matryoshka, designer Laura Howe added homemade costumes to the custom party dresses in her display window.
It's really pulled people into the store.
The costumes sold out, so she and partner Gina Rogers are making more.
Let's see, 6 pink things sticking out of a black and white cow dress. So those would be
the udders.
Prices range from $30 to $60. Big retailers Target and Victoria's Secret have designer costumes, too. Those go up to $200. Costumes may seem frivolous when money is tight, but retail analyst Wendy Liebman says Halloween is a recession-friendly holiday.
Cheap thrills, absolutely, and everybody happy for a moment inexpensively.
Unlike those other holidays around the corner, Halloween doesn't come with plane tickets, gifts, or fancy meals to worry about. I'm Eve Trow for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, October 27th. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers section at marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects the United States. The European Union today has unveiled a new trade plan, a major piece of which focuses on China. Europe and the U.S. want to convince Beijing to allow more foreign companies to bid on Chinese government contracts, a tough task for Europe and the U.S., as Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
China insists it gives foreign companies unfettered access to bid on contracts like those for state-owned enterprises and local government projects. But the country has refused to sign an international treaty that requires a more open bidding process. That's frustrated U.S. corporations who would love a piece of China's gigantic government contract pie. But for years, companies interested in bidding on public contracts in China were required to register their trademarks in China. James McGregor, author of 1 Billion Customers, says you might as well give the Chinese the blueprints to your product.
I talk to a lot of senior executives, and I've talked to a number of CEOs of tech companies in the last 6 months. And they may still be smiling when they come to Beijing, but behind closed doors, they're reassessing their business. Because it's no longer, will you lose your technology in the China market? It's now, will you lose your technology in the China market? And it'll come back and could destroy some of your businesses globally. That's the worry.
Because of China's policies, few foreign companies end up bidding on government contracts, leaving billions in potential revenue out of reach. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
In France today, the parliament voted to raise the minimum retirement age from 60 to 62. Now, that proposal has been highly controversial and has triggered strikes and protests all over the country. The BBC's Christian Fraser joins us now from Paris live. Good morning, Christian.
Good morning, Steve.
All right. This result was expected, and there were protests even before the vote. Now that it's official, are we expecting anything worse?
Well, the government fast-tracked this bill through the parliament, Steve, to try and draw the fire out of the protest, and in some ways that has worked. The unions have struggled, I think, to keep the same momentum that they've had in recent weeks. I think people are now resigned to the reforms, but they're still angry and they're frustrated that the president has not listened to some of their concerns and some of their thoughts on how the pension system should work.
And where are they protesting? What are they doing?
Well, we seem people going back to work in the south. The garbage collectors have gone back to work. Fuel stations are slowly being resupplied. The trains are running again. The big concern are the oil refineries. 7 out of 12 oil refineries in France at the moment are closed. The union that runs or supports the oil refinery workers is saying they're digging in. They're not refusing. They're refusing at the moment not to go back to work. I think the government will be concerned by that. There's no supply problem, but there is a refining problem, and that might mean in days to come that they will have to turn to the strategic oil reserve.
Well, let's talk about the government there. How has the French government handled these protests, and are they prepared for more?
I think they'll be pleased at the way that it's turned out. The president in particular has been unyielding despite the protest he's faced. Other presidents have backed down in the face of this union protest, but he did come to the country as a reformer. He will have that ticket to go to the country in 2012. The problem he has is that he has been bruised badly by the strikes over the last few weeks. His approval ratings have slipped below 30% for the first time, and we're only 18 months from a presidential election.
And Christian, finally, when is this retirement age change going to go into effect?
Well, the bill will be signed by the president in the next few weeks, and then it'll be phased in slowly. By June, at the end of June next year, people will have to work 41 and a half years for their full state pension. But there is a clause in this bill which the government promises they will look again at in 2013 to see whether the pension system is fair and to see if the system continues to be affordable.
The BBC's Christian Fraser in Paris. Christian, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
The head of British Airways has attacked what he calls completely unnecessary airport security checks. You know, when you have to take off your shoes or your belt in the security line? Well, the airline chief says the UK should stop kowtowing to US security demands. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from London with the latest. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
Why does he say these measures are unnecessary?
Because he says airport scanning equipment can now easily detect suspect materials that may be hidden in shoes or in clothing. His remarks reflect a general view among European airlines and airport operators that, as aviation consultant Laurie Price suggests, some of these security measures are frankly a waste of time.
Particularly when you see somebody, say, of 80 plus going through these things with this rather undignified thing of taking off belts, taking off shoes or whatever. Come on, let's start being a little more sensible about how we approach this whole process.
The BA chief also said that the practice of having laptops removed from bags to be checked separately should be ditched. He pointed out that laptops are now often being treated differently from iPads, such as the muddle over these security checks.
And the US, Stephen, is being blamed for a lot of these security measures?
Well, he is blaming the UK government in particular for what he calls kowtowing to the US, rushing to implement every measure the US calls for, even when the US doesn't impose all these checks consistently on its own domestic flights. The BA chief says he wants more consistency and a simpler, more rational approach to airport security.
All right, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, October 27th. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the numbers, check out the numbers section at our website, marketplace.org. The governor of New Jersey is expected to stand firm today on his decision to cancel a rail tunnel from the Garden State into Manhattan. Now, advocates say the tunnel is vital to the Garden State's economic future.
Other cash-strapped states, though, are looking for new sources of revenue, and they're finding it's easiest to tax things that everyone has. Sometimes they go a little overboard, and here with a surprising example of that is David Lazarus. He's a consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So we're talking about a product that everyone has. What is it?
It's the cell phone.
Uh-huh.
And according to the wireless industry, nearly 300 million of these things are around in the United States right now. That's almost 93% of the population sporting one of these handsets.
And these states, they all want to get a piece of this action.
Well, who wouldn't with a product that ubiquitous? The thing is, it's how they get at it. For example, some states, like New York, go after the service plan. They put these big taxes on the actual amount that's being charged for the service. Now, that's why there's a law in Congress right now that says, you got to scale that back. Lawmakers are trying to decide whether that's a good idea. Other states, however, go after the actual cell phone, the handset.
And how do they do that?
Well, in places like California, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, the way they do it is they have laws and rules that say we're not going to tax you on the discounted price. We're going to tax you on the full freight of the actual retail price, even though you might have gotten it bundled with a service plan that gave you a discount or even got you the phone for free.
So if I buy a cell phone that's, say, $200, you're saying I'm actually getting taxed on what the full price of that phone was that I never see that price, but it might be $400 or $500?
Let's say you're offered a jacket that normally retails for $500, but they're selling it to you for $200.
Yep.
Under no circumstances would you ever be taxed on the $500 value. You'd be taxed on the $200. What they're doing with cell phones, and as best as I can tell, only cell phones, is taxing you on the full value of the thing as opposed to the actual price.
And how is that fair?
It's not. Not that, but you find a point on it. And I put that question to California tax authorities, and they said, well, even though the tax code says one thing, tax regulations say another, and we're just going to go with tax regulations until anyone tells us otherwise. What they've done is essentially created a loophole whereby they can get more money for this ubiquitous consumer product until someone tells them to stop.
Loopholes are always good when they give you more money. All right, David Lazarus, consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The midterm elections are less than a week away, and the word on every politician's lips and the words you keep hearing in spot after spot, jobs. Well, this week we're taking a look at the future of some careers. And from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill introduces us to today's fastest growing field.
When you consider the jobs of the future, here are two of the big trends driving growth. Baby boomers who want more health care and technological progress. Biomedical engineering is a career at the intersection.
This is really kind of cutting edge, innovative.
Roger Moncarz is an economist with the Bureau of Labor Statistics. He says jobs for biomedical engineers are expected to grow 72% by 2018. The job also pays well. The median salary is nearly $80,000. But Moncarz points out the profession is in its infancy.
In percentage terms, it's impressive. In numeric terms, it's less impressive because it's only adding about 12,000 new jobs.
Those thousands of biomedical engineers could create the next device, procedure, or body tissue that spawns other jobs, manufacturing, sales, marketing. Dr. Ishiro Nishimura shows me around his lab at UCLA.
Many things are harmful chemicals, so I want you not to touch things.
Researchers have been over test tubes, hard at work. Their long-term hope is to help people who've lost part of their face due to accident or oral cancer by
remaking patients' face using their own tissues.
They want to grow facial tissues outside of the body and then transplant those tissues. Nishimura thinks graduates trained in both biology and engineering at one of the growing number of biomedical engineering programs around the country could make the idea a reality.
New scientists, they may feel that this is a workable goal, and they can create that.
Researchers at Wake Forest University in North Carolina are already growing hearts and bladders, possible replacement parts for baby boomers who want to stick around and see all these tech-inspired dreams come to life. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
And you can check out Marketplace.org for a handy tool. Just click on over to the Future Jobs-O-Matic section there. It's really neat.
And finally, tonight, people in New York, Steve, will actually be paying for bedbugs.
Wait. New York's had this problem with bedbugs for a long time now, right?
That's right. But tonight, a new musical opens, Bedbugs the Musical. It's a rock comedy musical, and it involves a woman whose mother was killed by bedbugs. I'm not sure, but I don't think there have any actually been cases.
I don't think you can die from bed bugs. You'll be scratching for a long time, but I don't think you'll die.
But she becomes an exterminator to get revenge, and then I think ends up falling in love with like a 6-foot-tall bed bug who's mutated into a huge size because of her extermination efforts. Anyway, if you want to find out the rest, you can go to the musical, but just make sure that you put your clothes in a high heat dryer afterwards so you don't bring the bed bugs back to L.A.
You buy a little bleach, too.
That's right. Does bleach kill bed bugs?
Bleach kills everything.
All right. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.